There'll be many questions I would like to ask if you wouldn't mind in advance, line up, come around the outside. It's hard to wind your way through, and we waste a little bit of a time. So please line up behind our speaker, the first of whom is Bev, and then we'll be able to proceed with our presentation quickly and easily. Gord, will you join me here? And remember that, as I do always, as you know, keep my words very succinct, very short. You know that. Thanks. All right, Bev, away we go.
Hi, Bev. I'm Michael Abington. Thank you so much
for your
very detailed analysis of what's happening, as scary as it is. I was reading last week's Maclean's magazine, which is quite interesting. I would recommend it to all of you as it focuses on the environment. And apparently, some of the oil companies have actually gone to using CO2 to extract the oil from the tar sands, killing two birds with one stone, using the CO2 emissions and not letting them go into the environment, extracting the tar sand, the oil, and then sequestering the CO2 into the earth below the tar sands. And apparently, that may be working. So I just wonder what your comments might be on that.
Well, it would certainly be an improvement if the oil companies can do that, and if they are doing it. I'm not sure about carbon sequestration, how long the carbon is going to be stored for, and whether it's going to start leaking out. But if they can perfect that technology, I'm all in favor of it. You're talking about the use of carbon dioxide to inject into wells, like they're doing in southern Saskatchewan as well. It sounds like a good technique to me. I'm not an expert on this part of the industry, but it's if they can reduce carbon emissions, it's a good thing. But I still think it isn't. I think even with those techniques, that the carbon emissions is still going to be great from the tar sands.
Can you all hear at the back? Yes? Hold up your hand if you do. You can hear? Thank you. Van, thank you.
My name is Van Christou, and I'd like to thank you as well, Gord, for coming down and giving us this factual food for thought on a very important topic. Energy is certainly one of the most important. It's not the only one, but it acts as an illustration of what we're losing out in Canada today, not just in terms of energy and our environment, but culturally as well. I just wrote down a quick thing here, a question, in order not to miss any, but with our democratically elected politicians at all three levels in Canada today showing so much immense generosity to the many powerful corporations, generosity at the expense of Mr. and Mrs. Average Canada, while knowing full well that every single powerful corporation is working for the culture of globalization with its consumerist amnesia and its suppression of historical memory. Without such a memory, reason and common sense, of course, are obliterated. They're eliminated. Do you see any force on the horizon which can serve to reverse this hemorrhaging of humanity?
Wow. Very, very good questions, very profound. Henry Kissinger, in a speech in Dublin in 1999, said that globalization is a new word for America's dominance in the world. I thought that was quite an accurate an accurate idea. You're right that it's in the interest of corporations to have an obliteration of memory and of culture so that they can sell the same products in the same way all over the world. But, of course, is that in the interest of humanity? Obviously not. I mean, I think we need cultural diversity like we need biological diversity. There are strong counter movements, especially in the global south, to this. I would say in Latin America is the strongest resistance, but in some other parts of the world as well, where I was in the Porto Alegre, the World Social Forum, 2 years ago, and I was in a huge meeting of people who wanted to have a Latin American integration to be able to stand up to the United States. And the Minister of Culture from Brazil, who was a singer, said we have to uphold two principles at the same time. We have to the sovereignty, the popular sovereignty of people, and the interdependence on all humanity, and we must make sure that one is not sacrificed for the other. That was Gilberto Gil, the Minister of Culture in Brazil. I thought that was a really good formulation.
Thank you very much for the talk you gave us at lunch. It was illuminating and depressing. I'm Margaret Lewis, by the way. And as some of you know, a number of us have been up in arms about problems of exporting electrical power to the United States through Alberta. And this ties in very nicely, I think, with your topic today, in that we discussed democracy, thanks to Dr. Christou, and we're supposedly living in a democratically elected government in Alberta, and so a number of us are planning on exerting our democratic rights, and we're calling for a public inquiry into the way in which electrical transmission and generation is being governed or not governed in Alberta. Now, this does tie in indeed to the problems of the oil sands and so on, because one of the major sources, as I understand it, for electric energy that is being proposed to be sent to the United States is from cogeneration in the tar sands. And I understand that this is going to be major. There was a huge, huge project being planned called the Northern Lights Project, and it's going to be the export of 2,000 megawatts of power to the U.S. down supposedly eastern Alberta, although it looks very much like it's coming right through here from the maps they give us. I wonder if you could explain to us a little bit about cogeneration and how the exploitation of the oil sands is causing problems in causing exports of electricity, which nobody, as far as I know, in Alberta has been asked whether or not we want to be involved in this.
That's an excellent question, and I agree with everything you say and your concerns. I'm not an expert on cogeneration, but I understand that there is a lot of surplus power that they are producing in the tar sands and that they then want to market for it. I should point out that the proportionality clause applies to electricity as well as oil and gas. It applies to all forms of energy. At the moment, we're exporting not that much of our electricity, but it's... But that would be locked in, and if we export more and more, then we get locked into that as long as we stay in NAFTA. The other thing is that once you start exporting any electricity, you are then subject to the rules of FERC, the American agency, and that they are the ones that are insisting on breaking up transmission and generation and distribution, which we have followed here in Alberta to not very good results, to much higher prices and problems a bit, and California did that too, you remember, a few years ago.
While you're getting to the mic, Doug, I understand, Marg, that you have copies of that document, do you?
Yes.
Outside this room, I think there are there, is that right?
Yes.
And can people take them with them?
We would prefer people to sign them here because we didn't bring enough copies for everybody.
Well, there's some copies anyway. Whatever it is outside there. Doug, Mark, sorry.
Mark Sandilands is my name. I really appreciate all the work that the Parkland Institute does. They're a small ship in a flotilla of right-wing think tanks, such as the Fraser Institute and the C.D. Howe Institute and so on. I'm happy that you're able to benefit from the fact that people who make donations to you are able to get tax relief. I'm a bit upset that the same rule does apply to such organizations as the Fraser Institute, but what can we do? Anyway, a technical question. I too am bothered by the proportionality clause. And I'm wondering if somehow we were able to put a moratorium on oil sands development, and furthermore were able to cut back on the amount of oil that was produced in the oil sands, as long as we exported the same proportion each year of our production, which I guess that's what the proportion is of.
Yes.
Then we could actually reduce the amount we export. Now, yes. I think that I agree with you, we should get rid of the proportionality clause, but I'm just wondering about that technical aspect about it.
Yes. Well, actually, if you really want to get technical, proportionality applies to total supplies, so they add the production in Canada to total imports on the production, and then it is a percentage. The percentage I've been giving as 63% of our oil is exported. That is right. That is of production. But if you look at it in terms of total supplies, you add imports into it, it's about 45%. But you're right that we could have a moratorium in the tar sands and increase our, as long as we kept our proportion at the same level as it is now, you could actually cut production in Canada, and as long as Canadians are cutting it at the same proportion as our exports, we can do that as well. But I think it's still very difficult to have a full program of dealing with carbon emissions if we have to export two-thirds of our oil.
Hi, my name is Dorothy McKenna. I like to live in a fantasy world.
Okay.
Having read an article in the last edition of Alberta Views about what Alberta would be like if the NDP ran Alberta. So let us say in this fantasy world that Canada did withdraw from NAFTA and oil sands production was cut way back, and we stopped exporting all of our oil and gas and probably water to the U.S. Now I'm worried about retaliation. What do you think would happen if? And what are our elected officials afraid of?
Very good question. Several things. You should know that in 1938 that Mexico nationalized all of its oil industry and the U.S. Marines did not go in. Mexico now celebrates every year its National Oil Independence Day as a national holiday. If Canada replaced the imports, 850,000 barrels a day, and we reduced exports to that same level, we could tell the Americans that those imports that we previously got, you can have access to. So that in itself is not a reduction of supply in the international market. You are welcome to those sources of imports that we have been using. I think the biggest problem, George Grant, who wrote a wonderful book 40 years ago, Lament for a Nation, said that American capital has an ability to incarnate itself as an indigenous ruling class. So that the biggest problem is that you have a fifth column in Canada. What you have is the American business community and other foreign business that are very absolutely central to what is called the Canadian business community. So when the Canadian government sits down and talks to the Council of Chief Executives of those 150 largest corporations, about 60 of them are foreign-owned. And that is considered an internal force within Canada. And they would, along with their Canadian counterparts, because the biggest Canadian corporations deal with them and are very much making alliance with them, they will work very much to undermine any concerted Canadian government policy. So I think that the first line of attack that the Americans would do is that they would start a big lobby campaign and advertising and television, and the business community or the corporations would be trying to scare Canadians. In terms of economic retaliation, it's possible that there might be some, but we actually are in a very strong driver's seat. If we actually used our oil as a bargaining chip, there, because oil, 80% of oil is now controlled in state-owned oil companies, there are very few opportunities for private corporations to invest in. So that whole idea that we have to just bend over backwards, I don't think is true. And the big thing would be to unite Canadians. That would be the big problem.
You're waiting for inspiration. You observed, I think, earlier, or someone did, that if there's going to be fundamental forces for change develop on this issue in Canada, the thrust will probably have to come from Alberta. If that is so, we have to bear in mind, following your last statement, that there are 30,000 oil personnel in Calgary from Houston alone, who are not without some influence in the politics of Alberta and this issue. Would you like to comment?
Yes, well, I do think that if we're going to have a change in energy policy, especially around oil and gas, the initiative has to come from Alberta. We know that the last time when there was an attempt at Canadianization, and I don't know if you know this, but the majority of Albertans supported the Canadianization aspects of the National Energy Program. They didn't support the federal government tax grab and trying to shift production to the Canada lands and away from Alberta and things like that. But the initiative has to come from Alberta, because if it comes from the east, they'll just, you know, they'll say this is totally anti-Alberta. But it has to be, we have to have a national or a Canada-wide perspective. So we have to figure out a new plan that would balance the interests of the producing regions, and Alberta's not the only one, Saskatchewan, BC, the Northwest Territories, Nova Scotia, New Brunswick, all are oil and gas producers, and recognizing the ownership and of the citizens and of First Nations people in those places, and the consuming regions, and to act, the interests of both have to be realized, and you would have to have a federal provincial plan. But we have a special responsibility in Alberta to come out with this progressive plan, because of the way that if it comes from elsewhere, the right in Alberta will try and scuttle it. Of course, we would have a huge battle within Alberta, the 30,000 people from Houston or whatever. And so it would be a battle royale, but, it started. Let's get up to it.
Professor Laxer, thank you so much for the presentation you've made. Are you aware?
Just before you start, let's list up.
Are you aware of the NAFTA superhighways that are being proposed in the United States at this point?
To some extent.
All right. I was made aware, and this is one of the reasons I'm here today, because I'm terrified about the Security and Prosperity Partnership. The United States people are being kept totally in the dark, number one, about the Security and Prosperity Partnership. Mm-hmm. Talk to most Americans, they have no idea.
Right.
But this was brought to my attention in November by a very dear friend of mine in Texas. The NAFTA superhighway was proposed to start in Texas at the Laredo border, going all the way to the Oklahoma border. Each state, of course, has their own right to do this. This superhighway, if built, and by the way, I should say, there was a moratorium passed just last month in the Texas legislature for 2 years not to build it. This highway, if built, is a 10-lane monster with two rail lines going down the center of it and oil and gas pipelines also going down the center of it. This is going to be built with taxpayers' dollars by a consortium out of Spain and will be guarded by Mexican soldiers on U.S. soil. I, frankly, am terrified to hear a situation like that, and I'd like your thoughts on this issue, because it would seem to me that everything I hear about Security and Prosperity Partnership is all about taking democracy away from we the people.
Absolutely. You couldn't have said it better. And it's taking it away, democracy away from we the people in all three countries. There are similar plans of roads from Atlantic Canada, from the Maritimes to New England. There are plans, you know, north-south highways from Alberta and into Mexico and right down into the to Panama, Plan Panama, I've forgotten the name of it now, from right through Central America. And the problem is if you put that infrastructure into place, it is then difficult to have a different policy. There are now 5 export pipelines from Alberta to the United States in the planning stages. For example, the Keystone Pipeline, the Trans-Canada Pipeline is proposing this. Parkland is has intervener status in this, as does the Council of Canadians and the Canadian Energy and Paper Workers Union. The idea was that they're taking some natural gas, which was going east-west to eastern Canada, take that out of natural gas usage, turn it into an oil pipeline, and send it right down to basically gets into Texas, 400,000 barrels. The Parkland, Communications and Energy Paper Workers Union asked Mike McCracken, a very well-known economist in Ottawa, what the impact would be of exporting that raw bitumen, 18,000 jobs per year, rather than upgrading it here in Alberta. And there are 5 pipelines like that. So if you add them together, we're talking something like 90,000 permanent jobs. The big problem with the boom that we're having in Alberta now is that this is a construction boom. And it's going to end. It's going to peak in 1 or 2 years, and then it's going to decline. And the operating jobs in that are much fewer than the construction jobs. So this is, you know, we've seen this before in Alberta, and this is absolutely the wrong way to go. So it's very important that we fight to make sure that the kind of infrastructure that you're talking about is just straight north-south, you know, doesn't happen. We need more east-west ties in Canada.
I enjoyed your talk very much. I got a lot of information out of it. I'm wondering if you have sort of encapsulated it somewhere in articles, 1 or 2 articles, particularly related to what we can do as a group or as...
Well, there is a table up at the back, a Parkland table. There's a Canadian Energy Security Strategy that we came out with 1.5 years ago. That goes into a lot of it. If you go into the Parkland website, we have a lot of material that we've written on this. So www.ualberta.ca/Parkland, and then you can download all of our research reports and articles and newspapers and things like that.
Fine. Thank you very much.
Okay, you're welcome.
Any further? Yes, Joe.
My name is James Moore. Thanks very much for coming, Gordon. Really nice to hear you. Just a little bit of context on what you were saying about the dispute resolution mechanism in NAFTA. When Simon Reisman was a chief negotiator for Canada at the beginning of the free trade agreement, there was a big argument where he actually walked away from the negotiations. Some of you might remember that. And the reason he walked out was because they wanted a dispute resolution mechanism.